Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going on since 1982. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and we go until past 11 usually. So I welcome you all here, and I hope that 2021 is a great year for all of us. It's got to get better than it was last year. So I wish you all the same thing last week, but this week as well. Have a happy and a very healthy new year, and let's hope that 2021 is a heck of a lot better. As always, I like to start the Technical Net with reminding you of a couple of little things. If you can't get onto the radio for whatever reason, and you have a question or a topic of interest, or a puzzle that you'd like me to share with the audience, or you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at a YouTube or any video or any news item and discuss it, the email address to reach us is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, interesting links will be available after the Technical Net. I have one up right now, and it's a nice new clean page for the year 2021. It's a very amusing YouTube video of a bunch of robots doing a dance, celebrating the onset of 2021. So anyone interested in that later on, you can get to the, my link page by just typing in roy.ac2gs.com. In addition, you can get to the chat room a few different ways. You can go into Limark's website, and you'll find a link for it there. But you could also type in chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll land you in the chat room. Again, the URL is chat.ac2gs.com. Also, you could advise friends who don't have access to either Echolink or IRLP or a radio that we stream this audio. And as of last week, a gentleman down in North Carolina, who's not a amateur, but a had a scanner when he lived in Nassau County, and he asked me, could I provide him a stream for Limark? And so I've set up this stream to run approximately 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you don't have a radio around and you want to listen in on what's going on in Limark, you just point your browser on your cell phone or whatever device to technet.ac2gs.com, and there'll be a running stream of Limark's W2VL repeater. So I don't know how long I'll be able to maintain that, but for the time being, it'll be there. And I want to remind everyone once again that MikeKC2NJI maintains a great archive of Technical Nets that go all the way back to September of 2006. So please avail yourself of it. Some of the smartest guys who have been on this Technical Net, Eric, Dick, John, Mel, so many people, so many interesting, useful bits of information. So take a look at that. Let me drop for a sec.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I just finished before I got timed out, so good timing. Want to remind people of the schedule for tonight, as always. I will ask people if they have any questions of a technical nature to give me their first name and their call sign. We'll put them down on a list. About 8:30, 8:45, Andy will be back with another episode of Andy's Corner. After his presentation, if I didn't get to all the questions, we'll finish up on those questions, and we'll open it up for any further questions, either of a radio technology aspect or, failing that, anything in science and or medicine, if people want to discuss the COVID virus or any technological thing going on. I'm game if you are. So that, and then Paul will come in at around 10:15 and do the space report until about 11 o'clock or so, and we'll tie a bow on it and wish you well. So that's the plan for tonight. Also, I just want to point out to people who haven't been keeping up with the news that the FCC was kind of threatening to charge $50 for a 10-year license. They've decided that that was a wee bit too exorbitant, so they issued a report a few days ago that they'll be charging $35 if you renew your license, if you get a new license, if you get a vanity license. They all require the $35 payment, and the license is then good for 10 years. So it's not presently legal yet. It has to be published by the government, and then 30 days after it's published, it goes into effect. So it'll be coming soon. So, you know, hold on to about $35 if your license is coming up due. Anyway, this is AC2GS. This is the technical debt. If you have any questions of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KC2TJC. Name is JC.
Okay, JC, could you give me your suffix again?
Kilo Charlie, 2 Tango Julia Charlie.
Okay, JC recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Kilo Delta 2, Victor, India, Foxtrot, Felix.
Okay, Felix recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight? Okay, very good. Hopefully people will come up with questions later on. JC, you're up first. So what's your question or your topic for tonight?
Thank you again. Happy New Year. I have three questions, and they could be done over the TechNet, or it's probably going to require one-on-one. I have a TYT MD380, and I'd like to set it up for DMR, and I have a DD4, a Delta Victor 4 Mini, that I have no idea how to use, and I'd like to set that up and have it working, so I need some help with that. I also have a question of what is the best mode for SLDG 20 meter.
Okay, let's kind of go backwards. You have FLDigi, and what band were you interested in?
So for the FLDigi, it's not the band exactly, it's the mode. What is the most popular operating mode that's in use?
Okay, the problem is that the most overwhelmingly popular data mode right now, I don't believe is covered. And FLDigi, I have it. Many people have it. It covers a lot of different modes. It covers PSK, RIDI, and a whole bunch of others. The golden technology this week, though, is FT8. Some people use a variant of it called JS8 call, but FT8 is probably, if you go to the data mode, except for today when RIDI had a contest, so you could have used it today very well to pick up lots of contesting signals on RIDI, but usually the mode that's going gangbusters is FT8, and unfortunately FLDigi doesn't really do anything for that. You need to get software specifically designed for FT8.
Okay, copy that. I could hopefully reach that kctjc@gmail.com. So it's my call sign, Kilo Charlie, 2 Tango, Julia Charlie, if somebody comes up with a better answer for anything that I ask. Thank you for that information. I'll look for software. About the other two questions?
Okay, before we get completely off FLDigi, I have found that it sort of depends upon the band and the time of day. PSK31 used to be a very popular mode, and that's available on FLDigi. I think it also is able to do slow scan images, which is not that popular. There's usually only about 10 different guys across the country who are just pumping out the old World War II and Korean War age postcards through slow scan TV, but that's also an option. Then going back to your first question, MD380. Let me drop for a sec. MD380 is not a big problem. What you need is a code plug. A lot of people have a lot of code plugs. Unfortunately, they're not universal in that you can't shove a MD380 code plug into a Anytone 868 or 878. But, you know, like they used to say in Green Acres, and I'm sure a lot of people were too young to remember Green Acres, I happen to have one on the truck. So if you want, if you send me an email just to remind me of your email address, I will send you a copy of my last version of MD380 that I've been using, because I also have an MD380.
Okay, it's actually a question that is for the DV4 Mini. So I have a DV4 Mini. It's supposed to allow me to use... It's a DV4 Mini as a hotspot, and it's supposed to allow me to use the 380 with it. Do I have to have a code plug specifically set up to work with the DV4 Mini, or will it the MD380 work independently and in addition be able to use the DV4 Mini on Simplex? There's just too many questions with this particular piece of hardware, and if you could remind me what's your email address, please.
Okay, I mean, you can send it to the email address that I mentioned, mailbag@ac2gs.com. You can send it to almost anything as long as the domain is at ac2gs.com. It'll reach me. Hotspots in general require you to change your code plug a little bit because, as you mentioned, it's a simplex operation. But you have to set the code plug to the right frequency of the simplex. And also, most likely, you're going to want to be transmitting different types of talk group headers. So you're probably going to want to add an entirely new zone specifically for operation with your hotspot that has a list of talk groups so that when you trigger it, it'll know which talk group to open up for you.
From what I've been researching, that sounds like the verbiage of what I need. I just have no idea how to set that up.
Okay. I mean, in short, the easiest solution is if you send me your email just to remind me, my MD380 is already set up for an open spot. So there isn't that much of a difference between how hotspots interact with DMR radios. You'll see that I'll leave it there. It'll have a zone. Actually, probably I have two open spots, so it'll have two zones. You can delete whatever you feel like, and it's just a matter of changing the simplex frequency for the one that your DV4 Mini is set for. And if you don't like the talk groups, you can modify it from there. So that's probably the easiest way. I mean, learning how to write code plugs is not incredibly hard. The problem, though, is that nothing else kind of trains you for it. The metaphors used for it are unusual for most hams because it came out of a commercial radio industry where, you know, they didn't really take any kind of guidance from regular ham repeaters or anything like that. So the metaphors of zones and channels and talk groups is foreign to many of us initially. Yes, Wes.
The DV4 Mini is limited to only mapped reflectors. Is that true?
I'm not sure. My understanding is that it can work fusion, D-Star, and DMR.
So I have a follow-up question on that. It works. It does say it can work fusion, D-Star, and DMR, but do I need an individual radio for each, or can I reach it using any 2-meter radio or 70-centimeter radio in simplex? KC, 2T, JC.
Okay, I do not know for sure because I really haven't had a great deal of experience with DB4 Mini. I had a bad experience with those guys because they were going to come out with the all-in-one radio that was going to be able to receive and transmit on all the modes, and that never happened. But it is my understanding that the DB4 Mini suffers from the same problem that most hotspots do, since they use something called a voice encoder decoder in order to compress the data rate and allow the bandwidth to be narrow enough to pass the FCC guidelines. So the chip is called an AMBI chip. The AMBI chip is in your radio. It is also in some hotspots. The OpenSpot 3 has a built-in dual AMBI chip. But without something like that, you have a problem in that D-Star, for some strange reason, uses a slightly older AMBI chip technology. So you can use your D-Star radio to talk to D-Star reflectors. You could use your DMR or your Fusion to talk to DMR or Fusion talk groups or rooms. But I don't believe that you can cross the D-Star into Fusion DMR at this time.
Understood. I happen to have a DMR, and I'd like to get that started. And yes, if you could send me that code plug. Let me just repeat your call sign. That's Kilo Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Is that your call sign?
No, it's Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra.
Okay, thank you very much for that. So I'll reach out to you via email. I don't want to hold anyone up. If you could send that to me, that would be wonderful to get me started. Thank you very much. KC to TJC.
Yes, Wesley.
What is the purpose of CW on FLTGI, and how many guys use it?
Yeah, are you talking Morse code?
That is correct.
I'm not quite sure if it has a CW decode mode available to it. It's been a while since I looked. There are other programs that do accomplish that. Another one that unfortunately, CW Snipper or something, that can actually, you can line it up with a wider bandwidth, and it'll capture the audio stream and give you multiple decodings of CW in a narrow bandwidth. But I'm not quite sure if FLDigi actually does CW translation.
It does CW.
Oh, okay. So it probably just does a single one, and I was kind of used to that multi-translation trick that the other software. So I never really got involved in using that for it. It's kind of like the Swiss Army knife of digital modes. And the price is certainly right. It's free. So, there's no real reason not to have it installed in your computer and hooked up to your radio's audio output. It's, it definitely is a beneficial and a free gadget to play with.
Ada, thank you for the information. Also, it does. We also PSK MF. SKRTGY, HEL, Domina, EX, Olivia, and Torp. Although I completely don't know what is Olivia and Torp.
I mean, ultimately, they're all digital modes with the different methods of getting the data with different degrees of error correction and redundancy. The FD8 has the most redundancy, and you know, it grabs the farthest away, and you could transmit and receive even when you're below the noise floor, which still seems like black magic to me. The only thing that I wish things like FL-Digi had, which is probably problematic, is a means to detect and figure out what mode is being transmitted. Because you can spend the better part of an hour just rifling through the different options until you actually land on the right one and you get intelligible text coming out of the decoder.
I'm mostly an old-fashioned guy, but it took not to completely dumb in it. I got into it.
Yeah, I mean, I always like new technologies. A lot of them are using phase shift keying and, as I said, redundancies and error correction. You know, they've borrowed a lot of concepts from computer sciences. But there's so many. And I have found websites that try to train you to figure out which one is being transmitted by the melody of the transmission, because some different modes sound completely different than others. But that always frustrated me. The amount of time it took me, if they weren't using something like RIDI or PSK to go to Olivia and all the others, it just takes too much time. So fascinating subject, and like I said before, the price is certainly right. So if you're interested in digital technology of any kind, digital modes in the HF band, download FL-Digi and give it a spin.
Story, you wake up in the morning, get into your radio. What is that you do it for?
It depends on the time of day. I mean, Sunday mornings, the first thing I'm doing is, because most of the time I'm net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club 10-meter net, I'm tuning up on 10 meters and looking around to see what kind of activity is going on. Very often I'll pull up my Flex 6700. It's capable of displaying most of the HF band simultaneously. It can receive 8 different radio signals out of 2 different antenna inputs at the same time, so I could gaze upon the entirety of HF and see what's busy and what's not busy. Like this morning, 10 meters was pretty much dead, as it usually is, unfortunately, in the sunspot minimum age, but 20, the lower end of 20 was very, very active, and I assume it was mostly RIDI contesters doing their thing. So that's I usually like to take the overview when I'm playing radio.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Felix, KD2VIF, do you have a question or a topic?
I do, yes. Thanks so much. I'm a new ham, maybe 5 days licensed. So learning a bit, and I kind of want to start at D-Star, and I guess the question is my experience where I communicate with a D-Star endpoint. I could hear them, they could hear me, and I tried to do an echo test and was unsuccessful. And what I'd like to know is, are all D-Star repeaters the same? Do they run different firmware versions that would have different functionality, support or not support an echo test? And then also, are there resources that can explain the D-Star as a protocol in the same way that one would, say, learn TCP/IP, for example, and learn about ACKs and SYNs and FINACKs and stuff like that?
Okay, very good, Felix. A very succinct question. Basically, there are, to my knowledge, only two different types of I'm thinking back with D-Star. As far as I'm aware, it's just a standard from ICOM. ICOM, I think, is the only people who make D-Star repeaters, and I think it's only one model. I don't recall them bringing out any others over time, but I could be wrong. One of the problems you might be suffering from is D-Star has a interesting requirement. You have to register with someone. It's not quite enough. If you have Fusion, which is a Yaesu technology, you enter your call sign when it boots up the first time, and that's pretty much it. If you hit the push-to-talk, if you go to Wires X rooms, it simply sees your call sign and passes you along. D-Star, for some strange reason, unless it's changed recently, you have to contact a usually local D-Star repeater operator and have your call sign registered with him. It is then shared across the world, and you can go to websites and see that you're listed as a registered D-Star user. So you might want to consider that. And, you know, as I've often said, Google is your friend. Google it, and it will tell you the packets, what the packets contain, what the protocols are. It'll give you as much information as you want. Thankfully, it's not a proprietary technology. It was fundamentally designed and implemented through the Japanese Amateur Radio Club. ICOM kind of came on board and made it their company's prime digital mode. But a lot of the information is readily available. The only thing that's hidden is, as I mentioned earlier, all these voice encoding technologies of D-Star, DMR, and Fusion require a voice encoder decoder. They're all the same company. They're all pretty much a version of an AMBI chip. The technology behind the AMBI chip is hidden away as intellectual property. Everything else you can probably dig out by just Googling.
Fantastic. Thanks for that. And as you were explaining that, I just did a quick search for D-Star packets, and I can already see the header frames. So thank you for pointing out the obvious. That'll be super useful. I did register, and still I'm having trouble, but I think as you mentioned, some quick Googling will make that clear for me. So look, thank you so much. I'm so glad that I found you guys and this resource, and I hope to hear you guys next Sunday. Kilo Delta 2, Victor, India, Foxtrot.
Great, Felix. And congratulations, and we're happy to have you in the fraternity. You know where we are every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and if you have any questions down the log, you know, you could just check in with us. Or, you know, that's the beauty of this hobby. Everyone's out to kind of help each other. So you'll get a lot of help out there. But, you know, we're here when you need us.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. Kilo Delta 2, Victor India, Foxtrot, 73.
Okay, very good. And it's now 8:29. Any second it'll be 8:30. And time for Andy and Andy's Corner. So I will summon Andy from his corner.
Okay. You got me. Good evening, gang. As we used to say on an old 10-meter net. Boy, I tell you, this digital stuff, it's over my head. So, got to come up to speed. I'm an old analog man. I still like playing around with AM. If anybody doesn't know what AM is, it's amplitude modulation. So, okay, so for people listening out there, it's Andy's Corner, and I'm Andy, WA2CDL. And I'm going to be talking about what we started last week, a subject called antennas and propagation. And just to recap, I went over, I'm not going to go over it again, but I went over last week basic laws of charges, electromagnetic, electrostatic laws, characteristics of radio waves, and how the wave itself leaving the antenna, and the polarizations of it. We discussed wavelength, what the definition of wavelength is, and you know, the speed of a radio signal, and how a radio wave actually travels along the an antenna, like a dipole antenna. How it leaves the antenna is still a mystery, but it does travel the length of the dipole, and the dipole needs to be resonant in order for it to radiate. Don't ask me why, that's the physics of it. No, actually, you can ask me why. There is certain characteristics of why a piece of wire will radiate a signal into space and will keep on traveling through great distances. So anyway, we were talking about that, and the different polarizations. You got horizontal, you got vertical polarizations, and how the polarizations change as the radio wave travels through space. So, and I make a few errors along the way because I forgot all the old stuff that I used to know, so I'm just kind of like bundling around. But I'm using this guide here to guide you guys, to give you a basic understanding, including myself, of you know, what's going on here and how all this stuff works. So I'm learning as much as you. So, of course, I have a million questions that I have to ask myself.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, the one thing I have to keep remembering is repeater timeout, which I'm tendency to talk too long. That's courtesy of HF. When I'm on the low bands, you could talk forever. Some people do. So we're going to continue our discussion tonight. And this will be an interesting one because it's how radio waves travel. I don't have as much time tonight as I had last week because I need to go to work tomorrow. So I'll see how far I get. But I have 1, 2, 3, 4. I got like 4.5 pages to talk about. And usually, it's just not reading. It's being interrupted while I read, or I'm interrupting myself. So I'm going to start with how radio waves travel. And if you guys close your eyes, you can get a visualization of what I'm talking about here, because there are some pictures, pictorials, and you know, which they show in this book. But if you have the, which is a great book, by the way, and I have the 19th edition of the ARRL antenna book. It's a great book for reference. It's a great book for building and designing antennas and any frequency throughout the amateur radio band up to the gigacycle or gigahertz range, microwave, parabolic dishes, beam antennas, and all the different types of antennas that are out there. So if you're so inclined, I would highly recommend the ARRL antenna book. And Roy may have a link on that, to how to get it, because I know it's for sale. You could buy it. And it's a great reference book. Okay, let me let it drop again. Sorry. Okay. And excuse me if I keep saying let me let it drop, because I don't just drop it, I keep saying it. So this is how radio waves travel. Okay, stand by just 1 second. Okay, I had to just look at something. Okay, the waves radiated from a transmitting antenna can be divided into three parts according to the way they travel. First, there are the sky waves, and there's a picture of showing what a sky wave looks like, in which the radio wave actually travels upward towards the sky. They may or may not return to the Earth, depending upon, the frequency of the wave and the conditions in the upper atmosphere. Ionized layers are present in the upper atmosphere, which bend some sky waves back to Earth. And of course, that depends on, you know, the time of day and conditions and so on, as we all have, you know, have witnessed and experienced. The second part is called a direct or space wave, because it travels over a nearly straight path between the transmitting and receiving antennas. Space waves can be direct or Earth reflected. That is, the wave can reach the receiving antenna by traveling through space directly to the antenna or by reflecting off the surface of the Earth. Okay, and the third part is the ground wave, which travels along the Earth's surface. All right, so the importance of each path carrying information from the transmitting antenna to the receiver depends on the frequency of the signal. Low-frequency signals are generally carried by ground waves. Medium-frequency signals are carried by both ground and sky waves. However, the medium-frequency sky waves do not vary far into the ionized region. So the signal returns to the Earth a short distance from the transmitting point. High-frequency signals, and I guess that's the HF bands we're talking about, which is, 10 to 80 meters, basically. High-frequency signals are carried mostly by sky waves. A sky wave in this frequency range will not be bent as sharply by the ionized layers and is reflected back to the Earth at a much greater distance from the transmitting point. And that's what we call skip. Everybody's heard of that term. You know, we hear stations from the Midwest and California and so on, and here we are in New York. So that's as a result of what happens with you on the HF bands. Therefore, high frequencies, which are really short, they call them short waves because it's a short wave band, are most useful in sending signals long distances. In the VHF and UHF frequency ranges, the radio wave takes on some of the characteristics of light. The signal is carried by a direct sky wave and follows almost a straight line path between the transmitting and receiving antennas. There is some refraction or bending in the lower atmosphere near the Earth's surface, which extends the reception range slightly beyond the horizon. That's beyond the horizon. The ionized condition of the upper atmosphere, however, has little influence on these frequencies, except under unusual circumstances. And one of them is called ducting, which usually happens when there's a warm front or a cold front that comes through. We get ducting in the summertime, more so in the wintertime. So it has to do with the warmer air layers and how it's ionizing the atmosphere. So, of course, I'm just mentioning that. It's not actually said here, but that's what occurs. The influence that the lower atmosphere, called the troposphere, that's tropo, and we use that word, you know, for tropo communications, T-R-O-P-O, sphere, troposphere, has on high-frequency transmission over great distances, particularly UHF and microwave signals, is evident in the phenomenon called duct propagation, or as we've heard of, you know, ducting. And we get that here on this repeater. The band opens up and we can hear repeaters far away. The very high moisture content in the air over seawater traps the transmitted waves between the surface of the Earth and the moisture-laden air. This causes the waves to travel around the curved surface of the Earth in a series of reflections between the Earth and the lower atmosphere. Now, again, you guys have to, like, visualize how I'm explaining this, because this is the way it's worded. And it's not too hard to see what they're talking about. The space in which the waves are bent acts like a duct. Duct propagation is often encountered over the ocean. Ducts can also occur over land. And by the way, it's duct. It's not ducts. It's D-U-C-T-S. S. Ducts. Like ducting. Can also occur over land, but this happens less frequently. Okay, there's another way of propagating waves. It's called scatter propagation. So still another form of high-frequency transmission is called scatter propagation. In this method of communication, extremely high-powered signals are directed at the proper angle toward the upper troposphere or into the lower regions of the ionosphere. And there's a picture which shows this, and you can see that as the Earth curves, the curvature of the Earth, and you can see how the scattering effect, there's a certain region, and the signal travels along the Earth, so the curvature of the Earth, it reaches a point where it scatters, and let's see, extremely high-powered signals are directed to the at the proper angle towards the upper troposphere or into the lower regions of the ionosphere, is shown. Very weak, I'm just describing the picture here, very weak but reliable signals scatter forward from these areas and return to the Earth at a much greater distance than ordinary ionospheric or tropospheric propagation paths permit. Scatter propagation can be used over a frequency range between 30 and 8,000 megs, that's 8 gigs. So it covers a very wide bandwidth, a very wide range of frequencies. Path lengths of 350 miles on UHF and 1,200 miles on VHF are practical and consistent. High-powered transmitters and sharply directional high-gain transmitting and receiving antennas are used for scatter systems. Yeah, and I knew a ham that had a high-power transmitter going to a multi-element beam, and he relied on scatter propagation all the time to make transmissions over the distances that were just described. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting how you think you could send a signal on VHF and UHF, at that distance, but using the scatter technique, you can.
Question.
Answer.
You are talking about ground waves and tilt tones towards the Earth. Electromagnetic waves goes through straight lines, they cannot tilt. So how is that being done? And the second question is, you were talking about ducting. How tall is the duct?
What do you mean by how tall is the duct? It doesn't go into the reasons or the explanation of the actual duct as far as the angle of the duct. I would have to go into the ARRL antenna book talks about that in a much greater detail, in more depth, which I'm not going into in this book that I'm describing this. So my suggestion is, if you don't have the antenna book, see if you could look it up on the internet or get it, because I know I've seen paragraphs pertaining to ducting and how the duct actually works. And that's all the information I have right now to convey.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with those two terms that you have made, but that's the opinion. Also, I disagree with wavefront slowing down through the currents they induce in the surface of the Earth. But well, I'm not going to touch on it. Thank you very much.
AC2GS?
Yes, Roy.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out this is what you're alluding to is the tropospheric ducting. It's much lower than the ionosphere level, so if people want to keep that in mind. And apparently the inversion layer is only about 300 feet wide, so it's a much closer phenomena than D, E, and F layer ionospheric effects.
Okay, very good. Yeah, the next section, section, if I can say it right, is the actual effects of the ionosphere and how it affects that. So we're going to go, we'll talk about that a little bit. But as far as getting more in depth, you know, again, that the handbook will explain it in more detail. Again, I'm just reading from this book called The Antenna and Propagation to give a basic discussion of what actually happens, what the waves do. All right, any questions so far? Any other questions?
How the ground wave could tilt if it's going through the straight line?
What you asked about, how does the ground wave travel in straight lines?
Electromagnetic waves can only go through the straight lines. It cannot bend. How the ground wave is being tilted if the electromagnetic wave can only go through the straight line?
Well, you know, like it said, you know, depending on the three different angles that the signal travels from your transmitting antenna, if you're going to you have a ground wave signal all the time, and then of course you have another signal that's traveling upward towards the ionosphere and bending back, and this is what I just discussed. You have a direct wave, you have a ground wave, and you have a wave traveling the upper atmosphere. So, okay, let me continue because I think the next few paragraphs will answer your questions because it deals with the effective of the ionosphere itself. So let me move on to that this paragraph.
Thank you very much for that. Photon cannot be bent, or trajectory of photon cannot be bent. Thank you.
Okay, very good. All right, so as I just mentioned about the scattering region, this is the phenomenon that occurs on UHF and VHF frequencies. Now, we're going to talk about the effect of the ionosphere itself. So it is apparent that the ionized air is very important. I should say it is apparent that the ionized air is very important in radio wave transmission. And let's see how the ionization is produced and why it has this effect. Okay, so this may answer your question, Wes. The Earth's atmosphere receives ultraviolet radiation from the sun, causing the gases in the upper atmosphere to become ionized. As a result of this ionization, there are many free electrons in the upper atmosphere. Ionization begins at the height of approximately 30 miles and continues up to about 300 miles. This portion of the atmosphere is called the ionosphere. Interaction between radio waves and the free electrons causes bending, which returns the waves to the Earth, and absorption, which weakens the radio wave. I should say, which weakens the return wave. So you have interaction because of the free electrons that causes the bending, which returns the radio waves back to the Earth, and then you have the absorption, which actual absorption weakens the wave itself. Both absorption and bending are greatest at lower frequencies. Very low frequency waves are completely absorbed. Very high frequency waves pass right through. In neither case is the wave returned to the Earth. For frequencies between these two extremes, both bending and absorption take place. At frequencies below about 5 megs, there is, in general, more absorption than the return wave. At frequencies above 5 megs, the absorption is quite small, and nearly all of the energy in the initial radio wave is returned to the Earth. Ionization does not take place evenly throughout the atmosphere. It occurs in layers, and this is where we talk about the different layers that that we have, and we've maybe was on some of the tests that you've taken, because you have the D layer and the E layer and the F1 and F2 layers and so on, and each layer follows the curvature of the Earth and is a certain height above the Earth itself. So they show a figure here of what that looks like. And ionized layers are in the upper atmosphere. So, as an example, the D layer is, according to this chart here, it's about 45 miles up from the Earth's surface. And the E layer is about 65 miles up. The troposphere, or tropo, is actually between the Earth itself and the D layer, which is the lowest layer. The next layer being the E layer, the next layer being the F1 layer, and I think it's F1. It's really hard to see that. The F layer is about 120 miles up. And then you got another layer above that, which is 200 miles up, which is the F2 layer. So this one is showing one, this is showing four layers in this particular example here. These layers differ in the number of free electrons and its thickness. Within any one layer, the number of free electrons varies with the hour of the day, the season of the year, and the amount of ultraviolet radiation. There are more free electrons in the center of a layer than there are at the upper and lower extremes. The higher layers have more free electrons than the lower layers. These ionized layers are called the Kennelly-Heaviside layers after their discoverers. And, have you ever heard that term? It's H-E-A-V-I-S-I-D-E. And that's the Kennelly-Heaviside layer. And I've heard that term, but I don't hear it that often. I'm just curious, Roy, have you heard that term, the Kennelly-Heaviside layer, as being used?
Yeah, it's kind of out of date. I don't think, I've never heard of it used on the radio. It's an old textbook.
So you're showing how old this book is. Okay. I've heard the term myself, but not often. All right, so each of these layers, the D, E, and F, have different effects on the different frequencies and at different times of the day, as I just mentioned. Each layer has its greatest density of free electrons at noon. The noontime density is greatest during the month of December, when the Earth is closest to the Sun, and least during the month of June, when the Earth is farthest from the Sun. The density of any layer is not constant over the entire surface of the Earth. It is greatest near the equator and least at the higher latitudes. Disturbances on the surface of the Sun that increase the ultraviolet radiation from the Sun also cause increased free electron density in the layers. One disturbance in particular that affects radio communications is the number of sunspots on the Sun's surface. These sunspots are large whirlpools in the gases that make up the surface of the Sun. The radiation of ultraviolet rays is much greater from the sunspot than it is from the undisturbed portion of the Sun's surface. Therefore, the number of spots on the surface of the sun directly affects the density of the atmospheric layers. Okay, now if you want to go into the physics of that, again, you can grab the next book. The antenna handbook, again, the ARRL antenna book does go into that. I was looking through it, but it gets a little bit deeper into the math behind it, as opposed to what I'm reading. So for anyone curious about this, you can do further reading on it. During periods of high sunspot activity, the ionized layers become very dense and cause radio and TV signals to be propagated over much greater distances than during periods of minimum sunspot activity. This can be a help to some broadcasters and broadcast services, but it may also cause interference between stations operating on or near the same frequency. And I think we've all experienced that when we get interference, especially when the band conditions, bands open and so on. So we hear stations that are far away, and that's just atmosphere. We call it atmospheric conditions. Scientists have noted that the sunspot activity varies at regular intervals. The minimum number of sunspots average around 4 at one time, and the maximum number has increased to over 200 during periods of intense sunspot activity. Yeah, I personally don't keep up with the sunspot activity, but I know there's a number that they go by. I'm just curious, Roy, do you know what the sunspot at this point in time? We just finished the December. Now we're into January, obviously we're getting closer to the sun, the days are getting longer. You know what the number is offhand? I'm just curious.
I'm not exactly sure what you're alluding to. There's a bunch of different factors. There's the seasonal variation, and also there's the sunspot cycle variation. We just got out of the trough. We're slowly inching up to the maximum, which will be about 5 years from now. It'll be a gradual improvement. We'll get closer to the sun, when we approach rather springtime. So things are going to be a little chilly until then.
Yeah, there's a K factor, or K index number that they that I've heard being used. Although I don't know what that number is right now. Okay. Thank you for that. So, continuing, astronomers who study the sun and plot the number of sunspots have found that the interval between periods of maximum sunspots is approximately 11 years. And I've heard that before, where we have the cycle, 11-year cycle. So we're in the process of coming out of the trough, where the sunspot activity is going to be increasing, or is increasing. So it says this is only an average. The period varies from 10 to 12 years. The sunspot cycles have been charted since the year 1750. Here is a list of years of peak sunspot activity near the present time. 1926, 1936, 1947, 57, and 68. Well, it doesn't go any higher than that. Probably 78, 88, and so on, but you can see there's a pattern of 26, 36, 10 years, 40, 47, 11 years, 57, 10 years. So, approximately 10 or 11 years, as it says, the cycle.
WS2N?
Yeah, this is your baby here. Go ahead.
Not really anybody. Back in September, they were going between 0 and like maybe 10 or something like that, 15. But then they predicted back then for like the next 3 months it was going to be going up. So, like in 60s and the 70s. So right now we should be in I guess I can get on the ARRL site or with NOAA there too. But my guess, you're probably in the 75 area right now, which is good. Back to you.
Okay, very good. So things are getting better.